Welcome to the Fastcast. I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
I'm Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And we're here to talk about all the fast and relevant things that we always do what talk about.
Yes, that one. Not so slow, more the fast.
Yes.
What are the happenings and what are they doing?
Yes, I have found this new year to be a bit challenging.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. As people might have intuited, or they might not have, I actually don't know what the audience thinks, I kind of struggled to edit the first Fastcast.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I should have known exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah, but like, I realized, like, man, you never really sort of said when we were going to start. But
yeah, I mean, if you hadn't said what you just said now, we could have pretended that their simultaneous two-episode release was part of the plan the whole time.
Yeah, but to be honest, like, I think it's far more interesting to reveal that I genuinely struggled a lot to edit that and put it out, and it took a lot of work, but I got there and I'm feeling good about moving forward.
So. I'm proud of you that you've done something hard but accomplished it anyway.
Yes,
don't let anybody tell you that things should be easy.
And as I said to Dave and a few other people, it's great that the biggest struggle in my life was a creative project and not my life.
Not like the bullshit happening around it.
Yes.
Something that's it actually ultimately is both optional and invigorating.
Yeah,
and
so, you know, they're
rewarding.
I feel very grateful that I'm in such a good place that I can struggle with my art, in quotation marks. But that's how I've been. How have you been, David?
Look, on the whole, I've been good. I've started keeping track of how long I can go before I have a conversation with someone who says something just so, like, infuriating that I can't even handle it. I'm up to 6 days on that. And to sort of give you context, it's statements like, The Last Jedi was ruined because Asian people were in it. Stuff like that.
Can't believe that's a thing people say.
Yeah. And so I hope, like, obviously there is a slight level of judgment in it, but I hope that we can all appreciate that it is the kind of judgment that is of a moral nature. Like, it is of not so much, oh, you fool, you didn't like the same movie I did. Oh, you fool, you didn't like a very good movie because you're kind of a little bit racist.
Mm.
That's more the thing I'm going for. So I'm up to 6 days on that, which is both kind of a good record break, but also supremely depressing. Those are the everyday frustrations of being alive. So it's nothing atypical.
Yeah.
Honestly, I've been doing pretty good.
I think the internet right now is full of a lot of that kind of frustration of, like,
there's
so much stuff. I mean, there's always stuff going on.
Do we want to jump into topic three for today?
We're the masters of our own destiny, David. We'll sail this ship wherever we want.
Yeah. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about this, but Nintendo announced, I think they're pronounced Labos, maybe Labos.
No
Labos
idea.
Makes more sense.
I say it in the quiet of my own mind, not out loud.
So it's basically Nintendo Papercraft.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you basically buy, there's two sets from what I understand, and the sets come with software to use it. One set is like an almost like an accessory kit of like a fishing rod and...
Yeah, it's like five or six different little widgets.
Yeah, basically little cardboard add-ons that you can attach to your Switch and to the Joy-Cons to kind of create these little interactive experiences using these really high quality cardboard sort of models.
At the very least, serviceable quality cardboard. Like, we don't know exactly how high it's going to be until we get hands on it. Yeah.
That's true. And also, what really impressed me about that is how it's not just the movement of the Joy-Cons, it's also like the IR sensors noticing like tabs, like white tabs that control different things. Like, it's quite complex for like a Papercraft thing. When I looked at it, I was kind of like, oh, this is like a cool thing for them to make because it's interesting and it uses, you know, cardboard so people can assemble it. They can feel connected to it. But also as a proof of concept for other companies and other people to develop things for the Switch as well.
Yeah, so it's definitely curious. I don't have any strong opinions about it one way or the other just yet. I am curious, if nothing else.
Yeah.
The thing that sort of ties into the starter of this topic is gamers be gamers, and Twitter got incredibly angry that a company released a product clearly designed for children. It's just another example of this sort of gamer entitlement that drives me up the fucking wall.
I have so many problems with this, right? And I'm going into a rant now, because my problem is, like, with the idea of things being designed for children, right? There are some things that are made for children. Mm. Like, you watch children's TV programming, right? That's very hard to digest as an adult.
Yeah.
Because the fact that it's a bunch of nonsensical random images, you have to be in a certain frame of mind to readily access that.
Yeah.
However, there are things that are made with children in mind that adults can enjoy, and there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
Shows like Adventure Time, for example.
See, the largest media conglomerate on the planet, for example.
Yeah, right?
Disney is who I'm talking about there. I don't actually know if they're the largest conglomerate, but you know what I mean. But
there are things that are made with children in mind, right? But there's nothing inherently... I feel like people conflate being made for children with, like, useless tat that's for idiots.
Well, see, I think that the problem is more internal, and I don't want to be too much of an armchair psychologist about this, but...
You are in an armchair, and we are psychologizing.
Yeah, yeah, so here we go. I think that, like any other thing that Gamergate fuckwits get angry about... is it's them feeling like it's them being pandered to marginally less than they're used to and being threatened by that kind of irrelevance. Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Oh, there's a game with a female protagonist in it. I think that someone made the comment about, I saw a comment on Mirror's Edge once, or maybe, no, Jim Sterling saw a comment for Mirror's Edge. And it was, there was nothing about Faith that required her to be a woman. And they were angry there was no reason she couldn't be a man. This is SJW bullshit. The very fact that there was no explicit reason she had to be a woman meant that it was offensive to this person that she was a woman. And it's like, it's such a perfect example of how default these people think of themselves as, you know, as protagonists and stuff, as the center of, like, marketing strategies and all that kind of thing. And so we look at something that isn't specifically designed for these people, they feel less at the center of attention, they feel threatened by it, and they lash out. That's what I see when I look at this.
If I was to rant for hours about how much I hate the Animal Crossing games because they're not made for me, people would be like, calm down, buddy. That's all right that things aren't made for
you.
But I feel like the same people who would tell me to relax are getting mad at things like this.
Perhaps a better example would be, I imagine a lot of the people who are angry at the Labos and that kind of thing probably love the fuck out of Dark Souls.
Yeah, a game that is intentionally
narrow in focus. And if I say Bloodborne's not for me, people, they don't get angry. I've never met a person who's been angry at me for not liking Dark Souls. Nobody's ever told me, oh, you just need to get good. Nobody's been completely obnoxious about it.
Which is
but
nice.
They have gotten a little bit defensive. For no reason other than the fact that I said, it's not really for me.
I feel like this comes up a lot more for, like, minority groups and
oh, absolutely.
All the time. Yeah. And just when you declare who you are. Like, when I say that I'm bisexual to people, that makes them uncomfortable. That's a thing with me, buddy. It's not with you. I'm doing the thing.
That be even more trivial than that. Like, I don't drink, right? Yeah. Like, that's not... That, like, it is technically a life decision, but it's not, like, an identity about myself. It's not a cultural thing. I just don't like it. You know, and it's how uncomfortable and defensive some people get when I say something that simple. To the point where, like, you know, someone will say, hey, can I get you a beer? And I'm more likely to say, no, thank, I'm driving, than I am to say, oh, no, thank you, I don't drink.
Yeah.
Because if you say, I'm driving, they just stop. just stop there. There's a couple of great video pieces. We've talked about this before, like Angry Jack, Why Are You So Angry? You know, that series of YouTube videos that talks about this idea that a lot of people think in very binary ways. They don't think in nuance. And so if they see something not being for them, they kind of see it as being against them. If you say, I don't like the thing you like, they take that as a personal attack of, I don't like the way you think and you're wrong for liking this thing, when really it's a lot more relaxed than that. And a helpful piece of advice from a particular perspective is something that Travis McElroy said that I took to heart very immediately after hearing it. Nobody thinks about you anywhere near as much as you think about yourself. And so if somebody says, I like Dark Souls, and I'm like, I don't like Dark Souls, I'm not really thinking about that person all that much. But they think that I'm thinking about them. If somebody says, hey, do you want a beer? And I say, no, thanks, I don't drink. I'm not judging that person because I don't give a fuck. I'm not judging you anywhere near as much as you think I am, or you're judging yourself.
Yeah.
And that's where I think a lot of that energy and anger and aggressiveness comes from. And for all of it to be about literal cardboard toys is just like maybe another factor is that they think that I like the Switch. The Switch is turning itself into a toy for kids. I don't like baby things. I'm a big boy. Fuck you for making things that aren't for me. I'm a big boy. I'm not a baby.
But I think there's something lost when we pretend that like the innocence of like being a child and the joy that can be found there is something we need to remove ourselves from.
Yeah.
Right? Like wonder. Should we remove ourselves from wonder? Amazement at simple things. Like,
and there's so many pieces of art that do grow with us. Like Harry Potter got older as its audience got older. It got more mature as it went on. It got darker, right? And sure, it's still really nuffy pop culture, whatever. It's not, you know, some kind of magnum opus of like artistic transformation, but it is an example of something that aged as we did.
Yeah.
If we look at, you know, certain, like Doom, for example, the video game Doom. Yes, that's very reminiscent of what it was, but the Doom from 2016 is very different from the Doom of, you know, the mid-90s or whatever. There is so much art that does grow with us and does become more mature. And it's, I think it's so frustrating that people get angry at both of those things happening. That Pokemon stays the same, right? And people are like, thumbs up Pokemon, but then we have this thing that's still for kids and kids are supposed to enjoy it, but we're angry at that. Star Wars evolves and changes and suddenly we're super angry at Star Wars because it's different and it's not staying the same it was when I was a kid. Ghostbusters changes and evolves and we're angry because it's not the same Ghostbusters from like 1984 or whatever. Why can't we just accept, like, why are we so blind to the fact that we have plenty of opportunities for both of these things? You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah,
that, like, there's so many things that grow with us and that's awesome. There are so many things that stay for kids. And that's awesome because kids deserve that shit too.
I've put myself in a place in my life where I'm glad when things end.
Mm.
Right? I relish. I find joy there when I watch a show and it's done. I'm happy. Mm. Right? Because I just not everything should go forever. But that being said, it's amazing that Pokemon just continues to live and be itself and keep doing that thing.
And that's just in fairness as well. Pokemon has become more nuanced since, like, they have more thorough themes in them now. I mean, one of them was literally talking about whether or not it was ethical to own and make Pokemon battle at all. That's pretty brave for a Pokemon game.
Yeah.
Ask that question.
For many years, they're
the entire premise of our game ethical?
You always assume that everyone was like, don't talk about how it's dogfighting. Don't talk about how it's dogfighting. Mm. Oh, no. We're going to talk about that now. Now, look, I don't know. I'm just... There's something there, though, about, like, you don't need to find joy in everything, but the way some people are even indifferent feels weird. I don't know.
I think that everyone is better served when we just accept that not everything is for us.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, a massive problem with a lot of dominant parts of a culture that, you know, that men need to learn that not everything is about men, that white people need to learn that not everything is for white people. And it comes the exact same way with people of a particular age group. You know, like, there was a lot of talk a few years ago about how, oh man, the average age of gamers is getting older and older and older. It hasn't really changed in the last 5 or so years. You know, the average age of gamers is sort of, a, you know, 25 to 32 in there.
Yeah.
And when we think about games that are designed to serve other age groups, like games that are a lot more accessible for older people who aren't as, you know, versed in the language of games and need an easier entrance to it. When we have games, especially like the Labos, which I think would serve as a really great introduction vector to the maker community as a whole, to people who want to do papercraft, who want to do tinkering, who want to get a Raspberry Pi, right? It's a great introduction to be curious about how things work and how things are built. And I think that there's a huge dismissal of that as well, where people will look at something like this as like, oh, what, you can make 5 things? But like, we need a starting point. We need a point where people can go, oh, this is kind of cool. I wonder what else I can do here.
There's a reason why when you're learning how to juggle, you throw one ball to another hand.
Yeah.
Like, you just throw a single ball.
And like, when you expand that to things, like, the one thing I always think back on is people who criticize someone like Anita Sarkeesian for like her feminist theory in her videos being so basic. She's like, oh, it's just women's studies 101. It's just a waste of time. I can't believe she gets so much attention. It takes attention away from real feminists. And it's like, but we need the 101 stuff to be accessible, and
it always they're always
you're clearly also just trying to tear her down because you are a straight white male gamer who doesn't like the idea of thinking intersectionally about video games.
Yeah, this this will always come up. Finding ways to introduce people will always be relevant because guess what? There's always people who need to be introduced to things.
I'm reminded of that XKCD comic where they're talking about the idea of meeting someone who doesn't know one of those facts that, quote, everybody knows.
Yeah.
And they do the fun maths on that, and they find out that if everybody knows this fact by, say, age 30, and, you know, blah, 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 there's something like 1,700 people learning this fact for the first time today. and you have two reactions when you find someone who doesn't know the thing that everybody, quote, already knows. You can either mock them and be a dick and make that person more ashamed about curiosity.
Yeah.
Or you can share the experience of discovery with them.
Yeah.
If they say, hey, I've never heard of this Mentos and Coke thing, what's that? Get a bottle of Coke and a fucking Mentos! Like,
yeah.
That's an awesome way to spend an afternoon!
We ain't gonna watch the video, we're gonna do this real. That's a great point. And I mean, I sometimes like to say the thing where it's like, if you don't know something and someone else does and they tell you, you've grown.
Yeah.
And that other person, I always used to say that other person's the same, but really they get to watch someone grow. Which is great.
Yeah, that's a fun experience. Yeah. Like, and if I'm going to be super self-interested here, one of the rewarding things about that is if you teach somebody something, you get to feel smart.
Yeah.
Like, it's fun to help someone explore that and like encourage their curiosity and feel like you've helped someone grow too. That's a good feeling.
It's very rare in my adult life that I feel smart. And I want to take every opportunity I can to relish that. So
yeah.
I think that's great. But there's joy in the world. I think that people need to just like understand that things are nuanced and there's reasons for them.
And the Twitter's reaction to the Labo bullshit is another example of why my day counter is so low.
Yeah.
moment.
If you want to see how Twitter treats things, just take any recent event, type it into the Twitter search bar, and look at everyone's hot takes.
Yeah.
And just see how similar they all are. And it's like,
and how clever they think they fucking are. Anyway, look, I think it, like I said, it's worth being curious about. I think it's interesting, and I've said this before, like, even if you're not interested in the product yourself, anytime somebody does something weird and different, it revitalizes an industry.
Yeah.
Even if, like, there's no shame in being like, you know what, I love COD and FIFA on my console, I play for the year, I get the new one, that's the way I game, I love it, it's relaxing, I'm enthusiastic about that, awesome. Your enjoyment of that game is improved by more esoteric things outside it.
Yeah.
Because people, you know,
the way
think
we,
and they can, you know, steal ideas and shit.
Yeah, the way we form and grow ideas is not only, we don't just move forward, we move sideways as well.
Yeah.
And the more you experience, the better things
and
will
like
be.
And like really, really generic examples, in a game like Call of Duty or, you know, your shooter of the month. We now have like a progression mechanic and an RPG elements from other games because other games did that and it was cool and we melded it together.
And I wasn't there when the game started.
Yeah, in games like FIFA, we have this whole like manager side of things now because there were little sims that did that stuff and people thought that was awesome and so they injected it into this game.
There's like, a single player component to the FIFA games now.
Yeah, and like the idea
a story
that
mode.
Even like the biggest budget, safest bet games get like don't benefit from weird indie stuff and like weird experimentation. I think that like even if you hate the idea of like Labos or whatever, you are going to have better games because they exist.
Yeah. And we can all be happy about that because we like better games. So speaking of better games, you've been playing Wolfenstein 2.
I have. I finally got around to playing Wolfenstein 2. If you folks have listened to our episode on that, I was extremely disappointed in it.
Yeah?
Now, I think that my
You mean the Wolfenstein. I thought you meant the
Wolfenstein
episode.
Yeah, the Wolfenstein 1 episode. We were extremely I was extremely disappointed.
That episode, that's a really weird, like, interesting episode to listen back to.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot to talk about, and so it's a good episode, but bad feelings, honestly.
Yeah.
Wolfenstein 2, my reaction to that was significantly better. I think part of it, in fairness, is because Wolfenstein 1 set the bar so low, because I went into Wolfenstein 1 with my bar set at Doom,
yeah,
right? And I got Wolfenstein 1, now I've gone into Wolfenstein 2 with my bar set at Wolfenstein 1. It is a lot better in a lot of different ways. The plot structure is easier to follow, and a lot of the cinematography is better, and the way they do exposition is better.
When I looked at the trailers for the game as well, I saw a lot more in there. Like, I know that's a very simplistic way to look at something because I haven't experienced Wolfenstein 2 yet. But when I look at the trailer for, like, Wolfenstein 1 and I compare it to the stuff for Wolfenstein 2, there seems to be a lot more ideas present.
I think that they are approaching their ideas in a better way, definitely.
Cool. That's good because I think that was one of our problems with Wolfenstein 1.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the big things that the ads push for, I will confess, I'm not finished in Wolfenstein 2 yet. Yeah. I thought I was, like, 90% of the way through it. I think I'm only, like, 60% of the way through it, based on another story thing that's happened. There are some scenes in there that are really like, holy shit.
I've watched some of them on YouTube out of context.
So one of the things that they do cover is, like, in all of the marketing was like, make America Nazi free again and stuff like that. Like, in the marketing, they're very deliberately calling towards things like the alt-right and Trump supporters. The game feels more and less divorced from that at different points in it. And so at some points I'm playing it, I'm like, holy shit. Like most of the time I'm playing it, I'm like, yeah, they do have this. They do talk about how the Ku Klux Klan like the fact that the Nazis took over and stuff like that. That feels like it was going to be in the game from the beginning.
Yeah.
Then there's one or two points where I'm playing it, I'm like, holy fuck, this is such an explicit dig at the current political climate.
Wow.
This is a spoiler.
All right, spoiler zone.
Spoiler zone for Wolfenstein 2. There's a point where you meet Hitler.
Yep. This is the part I watched on YouTube.
Yeah, and a lot of people will have seen this scene on YouTube. The way they depict Hitler's behavior is incredibly... I was very... To say impressed is the wrong word, but they did a lot better than I think that they would have expected them to do. Because there's a lot of different ways you can depict Hitler in a game like this. You can depict him as the big bad, this dark authoritarian.
Scary, impressive.
You can depict him as, like, someone with a vision who was, like, manipulated by... Or, you know, someone whose goals for Germany got away from him in a really, like, shitty way to sort of sympathize with him.
Yeah.
The way that they depicted Hitler in this, it is impossible for the alt-right to be happy with it and to reclaim that.
Yes.
He is angry and misguided and just like so full of himself, and he repeats the same stories over and over again. He's like very disgusting. Like, his hygiene is bad. The way he talks to people is disrespectful. He's unfocused. And I can see them making this character as it is and just accidentally having that parallel. The current president of the United States, it seems very, very, very closely tied to that, though.
It reminds me of the idea of how important it is to not mythologize the people, like, especially when we talk about the alt-right and things like that, and racists and Nazis. Oh, that's weird. They're still here. it's best not to be afraid of the boogeyman, but to realize how ridiculous and gross they can be and treat them that way,
I feel like to appreciate the threat that they pose without turning them into Emperor Palpatine, like this big bad that we can defeat with a legendary sword.
Which,
you know,
goes to my favorite video of people mocking the alt-right, which is a man with a sousaphone marching behind them going, bwomp, bwadum, bwomp, bwadum, which the video will be in the description.
Yeah.
And I feel like, in a way, they've kind of done that by making him this just terrible person.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, the fact that he's the... Because the game's set in the 60s, so Hitler is much older than any of our records of him, because he never got past, you know, 1945, 1946, whatever the year he actually died.
Certainly didn't flee to Brazil.
Yeah, all of that bullshit. And so to have him be senile and, like, just constantly reiterating, like, the glory days and talking about how he's so smart and he's such a great artist. Like, the way they depict him in this is not as, like, the supreme commander of all the armed forces and anything. He's a director for a film, and he's trying to make this propaganda movie, and he's just talking about how, oh, you know, if you read my book, you'll see how smart I was about this, and, like, I understand this character better than anybody else, and just, because it's all done, and this, I think, is also very clever. You know, there's that thing people say that if you take Trump's speeches and just read them rather than hear them, how unfocused and stupid they are when you divorce them from his oratory?
Yeah.
Hitler only speaks German. Right. And so everything that you, if you're not a German speaker, you're just reading subtitles for what he's saying. And so it divorces his words from the way he's saying them. And it just shows how petty they are. And it's very, very good. There are some things in it that are not as good, but they're much less frequent than what I've seen in the other Wolfenstein. The cutscenes are still, they still suffer from that Michael Bay-ishness of every single cut is high energy and it makes it seem like everything is important. So you don't really absorb the actually important
stuff
from cutscenes. Yeah, it's just like, because everything is so high octane.
Fine.
There's a new character called Grace, who is a black woman from New York, and she's like high up in the resistance.
Features heavily in the marketing.
Good character. I really like her. There's some Roswell stuff with space aliens that's fun. There is also a character who is, you know, General Engel from the first game?
Yeah.
Her daughter is in this game. She is a overweight woman who is also, at least, I think, bisexual. Her mother is constantly berating her about how, you know, how deviant she is.
Right.
And, like, you know, there's references to the fact that the only reason she's not in a camp is because she's this general's daughter. And, you know, the mother's just like, you're disgusting. You're a disgrace to my family name. And, like, really, you know.
Gross.
Really gross stuff. And I had high hopes for that character and the way that they depicted her. And for a lot of the game, it's pretty good. But as soon as she's on the ship with you, with your crew, everyone's just constantly calling her Nazi. You're like, oh yeah, fuck off Nazi, and that kind of thing. And I think that there's a way to talk about that, the fact that this character has benefited in some ways from her position in the Nazi societal structure, but is also still ultimately a victim of that because of her sexual identity and because of her body and because of things like that.
I haven't played it, so I don't really know, but it sounds like they've lost the opportunity to provide some sort of commentary by being in that.
I think they're trying, but you have this moment where a lot of the characters are just like, fuck off Nazi, fuck off Nazi, fuck off Nazi. And she's emotionally she's clearly just been stomped on a lot through her whole life. So she's very deferential and she doesn't have a lot of assertiveness. And so she just, you know, she takes it and you can see she's quite emotionally hurt by that language. And it gets to a point where Grace, and this is the most recent scene that I've seen, Grace says, you know, this to her, you know, fuck off, you fucking Nazi, get the fuck out of here. And she snaps, and she's quite a physically imposing person. And so she grabs Grace by the throat and strangles her and starts screaming at her, you know, how dare you call me this? How dare you constantly say this to me? How dare you call me something that's less than human? That's literally one of the lines that she gives. And I think the idea is trying to explore the irony of that and how, you know, this character is also has, you know, suffered for her whole life, but it comes across as really bad that you have this Aryan woman choking out a black woman and insisting that calling her a Nazi is as bad as calling, you know, as saying that people who aren't Aryan should be killed or turned into slaves and that kind of thing.
Like, I feel like I have to do some I feel like I have to do some real meta textual jumps to think of it as even being an analysis. So that just seems a bit mismanaged.
Like, I honestly think they're trying to make a parallel there, but it's just, it doesn't come through very well because in this moment, they don't make the suffering that Sigrun is the character that Sigrun has suffered at the hands of the Nazi regime. They don't forward that enough here. It's just like her breaking point is that people kept calling her a Nazi.
Okay.
Right. And again, if you're a victim of Nazism and get called a Nazi, I totally understand why that's hurtful.
Yeah.
But they don't make that point clear. It's just that she's saying, like, you saying the word Nazi is just like me saying, insert volatile racial slur here.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't quite land. So there is still, I think, problems with it on the whole. But like I said, it's much better in a lot of different ways, in the way that it talks about America's kind of issues with white supremacy.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest difference. That the game is set in the US. Is it for the majority of the time? Or?
Honestly, no, not so far. Like, the plot of the game is to liberate the US and use that as the seat of the, like, that's the jumping off point for overthrowing the Nazis. If we can free America, that's step one.
Yeah.
But most of the game is actually set in all kinds of places, like Venus. So there are scenes in, like, this idyllic little country town near Roswell, where you've got Nazi demonstrations and the Ku Klux Klan, you know, openly wearing their robes in public, and people saying, "Oh yeah, the Nazis are great," and you know, like you know, one or two Nazi characters, like kind of more over the top Nazi officers, really talking about how great American culture is because it really understands, you know, the Aryan destiny and that kind of stuff. So it's all very explicit.
Yeah,
and there's stuff with Blazkowicz's parents as well.
Yeah, I heard that.
So we get the first in-game to my knowledge, this is the first time in-game they've explicitly said that Blazkowicz has Jewish ancestry. So you see a lot of his mother, who I believe is Polish. His father, who is a WASP, basically, he's a white Christian, you know, upstanding American. And, you know, he sold out Blazkowicz's mother when the Nazis came in, and he's talking about how much better his life is now that the Nazis are there and they don't have to worry about all of these other subhumans ruining society and making life harder for him as a hardworking white man and that kind of stuff.
So, yeah, like you said, it does sound like they are really going for it a little bit more, which is great because I think that was a big problem with the first
game. And so far, the whole America has problems with white supremacy thing, they haven't fucked up there, right? Yeah. Like, I think they could have gone further and they could have made it seem a little bit less niche than it is, but they still, they've done well so far with at least that part of it.
Well, it's good to see that they're sort of doing stuff with it.
Yeah.
And not just redoing the first kind
of game. I'll let you know how I feel when it's finished, but like I said, so far, step in the right direction.
Cool. Well, I think the last thing we're really going to talk about is the fact that Dark Souls is getting a remake.
Yes. So, Dark Souls is getting remade for basically everything.
I think is it, because I know specifically from what I understand, it's for the Switch, main thing.
Yeah, but it's also for current gen consoles for the
PlayStation
Xbox 4, One
Xbox
and
One.
And the PS4, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Because it is the only Dark Souls that can't currently be played on those current gen consoles, right? Yeah, so
you gotta Skyrim that stuff up so everyone can play it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's getting re-released. I doubt I'll play it, honestly. It's so not my kind of game. But then again, do own a Switch. Might be something fun to pull out of my pocket every now and then, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I've always wanted to play Dark Souls, you know? Mm. I was excited to play Bloodborne, and I still kind of want to go back to it at some point. And play a little bit more,
because yeah.
I think there's some interesting things there.
I think that Bloodborne was harmed by the time pressure that we put on ourselves to play it, because it is a game of patience.
We picked some really long games to play right at the start,
yeah. And I think that now that I have a better idea of what's actually coming afterwards, I have a few more of those lights at the end of the tunnel to go for.
Mm.
And so maybe Dark Souls is a game that I should look into, but when we talk about things like patience and time, I mean, being time poor is a premise of this podcast.
oh boy.
On my comment as well of potentially getting it for the Switch, I think it's interesting that it's coming for the Switch, because it's not really a pick up and play kind of game. You know, it's not like a Stardew Valley or a Minecraft that you can just play for like 5 minutes at a time, I don't think.
So see, this is kind of why I was excited that it was coming for the Switch, because I wouldn't mind on a commute sitting down and doing a run and playing through it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, I feel like the very fact that the game is such a slog is difficult, and any excuse I can have to physically impose some breaks,
that's a good
would be
point.
Very helpful for
me. If you force it into a portable thing, like the platform itself almost necessitates stopping points that the game itself might not have baked in.
Yeah, console only has so much battery, you know what I mean?
And the other thing that's very good about that too is, like, if you're between bonfires on a PS4, you haven't got to your next bonfire, you've just got to, like, I guess, leave the console running. You can probably put it in sleep mode.
Actually, now I think about it, you can't pause Dark Souls.
I don't know. I thought you could. Yeah. You could pause Bloodborne, certainly.
Maybe. Yeah.
But, like, if you put it into sleep mode, I don't know if a PS3 or an Xbox 360 had a compelling sleep mode. The PS4 kind of does, but honestly, the kind of heat that thing throws off when it's asleep, that's not power efficient.
Yeah. Sleep is in inverted commas. It's like the kind of sleep where you cross the road and make dinner.
Yeah, but, like, the fact that even if it's an inefficient sleep like on a PS4, it gives you a way to kind of work around the long distance between save points, and so with a Switch you can just go, all right, go to sleep console, and it holds the game where it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have a Xbox One. It probably has a similar sleep function as well.
I say that though, but I kind of do feel like my play of games like Persona, which is quite a long game, has been harmed by the fact that if I take a break from it for a month, I really don't know where I'm up to, and I have to kind of relearn it. So, you know, it's a balancing act.
And different people have different responses to that. I think listening to a bunch of podcasts that were talking about what's our game of the year, whenever they talked about a game that was on Switch, the fact that the game was portable, there was always a discussion is, are we allowed to factor that in to whether or not this game is better than another game that isn't on the Switch? Because, you know, I can just play Breath of the Wild anywhere I am. I can play Dark Souls anywhere I am. I'm of the mind that porting to a Nintendo Switch and getting that extra, like the huge jump of portability that platform has, that is a transformative port in a lot of ways for a game. Jim Sterling had a similar video about how, you know, the fact that there are so many ports on the Switch is actually a really good thing, because it means something. It isn't just a shitty cash grab.
I think the Wii U was marred by the fact that not a lot of people were bringing things to it. And if they did bring things to it, it was in a, what would one, I think I would call it a compromised way.
And so when we have even games like, to me, that don't really, like, I don't think I would get a lot of portable play out of a game like Dark Souls, it still is a big difference to the experience of that game. Even though, like I say, Dark Souls isn't really something that is my jam, I'm more likely to buy it now than I was before.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a big, it's a big change. Like, it adds...
It adds something to the proposition, the value proposition of a game.
Absolutely, yeah. And
I always want people to think about an experience, like a game, in a little bit more than just the game itself, in the how it can interface with your life.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, we're sort of spiraling back to the Labos thing now, that, like, that kind of interface matters.
Not only that, though, not physical, but, like, also mental interface, too. Like, I feel like, you know, some games can put you in a dark place. Some games can catch you in their repetitive loops.
Yeah.
Right? These are things we need to manage and understand. That's why drugs and alcohol and gambling all have flaws around them and their use, right? They need to be managed. And I think that sometimes games, too, that you need to understand what's getting involved and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, looking at a game is not just a thing to do, but like how it can fit into your life and how it folds together and how it returns for you the time and investment you put into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Part of making it important. I think that, you know, again, more options enhances the way people can find what suits them. There are some people who would say, I can't have Dark Souls in my pocket because I will never stop playing it. Yeah. But then there are other people who are like, well, I can pace, like you were saying, I can pace this game in a better way that keeps me more invested, but also, because it's on something that's a little bit small, like if I'm sitting in front of my computer to do some, like, professional work, it's not going to distract me because it's on this separate codified device. You know, I think that, like, thinking about those boundaries and those interfaces is really important, to, like you say, to our understanding of how we game.
I think we're both very into being mindful and understanding how even mode shifting things from device to device is just useful. Like, and also for me, I don't like exclusives. Like, you know, I understand them as business value propositions. I understand why Bayonetta keeps appearing on Nintendo stuff. It's because Nintendo gave them a lot of money to make the game.
Yeah.
It makes perfect sense, right? But in my mind, I like the idea that we'll all be, you know, unilateral with access to things on different platforms.
Yeah.
At some point, it'll get there.
I think that when we talk about exclusives, people who like exclusives like games that have been exclusive, and their enjoyment of that game would not be diminished if the game was not exclusive. I mean, Horizon Zero Dawn is our most recent episode. That was an exclusive. That was an amazing game.
I wish people on Xbox One could play that game.
Yeah, I wish
that. Without having to pay $400 or however many dollars to experience it.
Some people aren't as charismatic and just, you know, they're sexy and alluring as I am, they can't get their podcast co-hosts to lend them their PS4.
Yeah, they're not everyone's as mesmerizing as you, David.
Yeah,
that's,
you know, not everybody has this, like, the raw charisma and charm to get people to lend them $500 pieces of entertainment equipment.
Honestly, everybody,
weeks at a time.
I'm melting right now, but it might be the heat.
And like you say, it's cool that it's getting re-released. It's cool for the people who enjoy the game.
I used to get mad at the idea of games getting re-released all the time, but in a way, it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, you really don't need to buy it. You don't need to buy the Blu-ray version of Star Wars, right? If you've got a DVD copy.
You made the joke about Skyrim, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to fucking buy Skyrim on the Switch. If I was going to buy Skyrim, I would have bought it one of the other 7 times it was re-released.
Yeah, I already own Skyrim.
This is the first re-release of this game. It's been remastered, the ways in which it's changing, not just for the Switch, but apparently, I don't know about the PC version, but people are anticipating there might be some big changes to that one in terms of, like, playability and bug fixes and things like that. I mean, that's hopeful. I don't know. But my point is that it's been long enough for a re-release, even a fairly typical, I guess we'll do a remaster on non-portable consoles, is understandable, you know? Yep. And if you want to buy it, hell yeah, high five. Play the games that you like.
Yeah. Exactly. Play the games that you like. Really, don't play games that you don't like.
Yeah.
That sounds bad. Whoever's making you do that, tell them to stop. Tell them the Slowpokes told them to stop.
Yeah. Fuck them. All right. I think that might be us for the Fastcast this week.
Yeah.
If you like what we do, you can find us on iTunes. Give us a review. We appreciate that. Our website is slowpokespodcast.com. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/slowpokespodcast, and we're at slowpokescast on Twitter. Our next game is
Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Yes. And I'm super looking forward to this one.
Yeah.
If you've listened to any of our past episodes, you've probably heard how excited I am, or how excited I want to be for A Way Out, I should say.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, this will be a good sort of litmus test to see if that's going to be anything more than its stamp on the box gimmick.
Yeah, I think we're both excited for A Way Out. So playing what the guys have made the guys, what the they've made before,
what the dudes, what the bros have made before,
yeah, what just the lads,
just what the boys down the pub have made prior.
Gendered language, get out of my head. What the people behind,
what the folks. I like folks is a good one.
It'd be interesting to see what they made before,
mm,
and potentially how that colours what they're going to make.
Yeah,
and having that context would just be good for insight.
It's also probably. It's a perfect example of a game that's been on my list for way too fucking long.
Same.
Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons. I think I bought that very shortly after it came out, and it's just been sitting in my Steam library since. So
let's not compare when we buy games to when we play them. The point is, we're playing them now. That's fine. Mum, don't look.
All right. Join us next week for that. In the meantime, I have been David.
I have been John.
Thank you so much for joining us for the Fastcast.
Have a great week. Yeah.